When did you start putting, you know, I guess you call it mental health advice or education. I don't know what you call that, but your words, but when did you start doing that on Instagram?
I think I would say it was probably around 2016. And that I know for sure because I graduated with my master's in social work in the year of 2015. But around that time, mental health was still very highly stigmatized. I don't think people were on Instagram around 2015 even promoting mental health content. I think we were still in the selfie universe, and people posting their brunch photos and inspirational messages. And I think there was a pivot where I started to see an influx of text-based content really flood Instagram, and a lot of that content started to be geared toward mental health, wellness, anything related to self-development, that really had a focus on our mental well-being. And so it was definitely around the time of 2016 that I've been doing the work that I do on Instagram.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah. Like, how did you see kind of like the transition between, I'm curious if there's any alignment of like the transition between people posting brunch, which like there's a weird part of me that social media has become so kind of contrived now in this way, it's sort of, you know, in a lot of cases that I kind of want to get back to like brunch photos and selfies. Like whenever the crossover started happening between Eggs Benedict and ideas around self-worth, like, did you notice anything in the culture that was shifting at the same time? Like, anything line up?
You know, that's a good question. I often reflect on that because I'm unsure what was happening on a societal level where people made this huge shift toward mental health. I'm quite sure something did take place. You know, it makes me think of 2020, because that is when my Instagram account really blew up, you know. So even though I've been doing this since 2016, you know, I had like a slow, steady pace of growth. But I believe by the time 2020 came, I probably gained about 100,000 new followers within a year, you know, and it had taken me about 3 years to even get to 20,000 followers. So that's a huge shift. But I think around the time I started to share mental health content, I was also writing for different blogs. And I do remember specifically writing a post for the Huffington Post, and it was about Black women's mental health. And I don't remember what events transpired during that year, but I do know there was like a big fixation, at least for me, on Black mental health, primarily for women. And I know that it played a role in why I started to write a lot of mental health content online specifically for Black women at that time. And now it's evolved to more than just Black women, but I know for me, that was the pivot, you know, and that is what encouraged me to shift the things I wrote about online.
Amazing. At that time, like, what was the transition that, you know, made the visibility of Black women being comfortable in public saying, hey, I'm down to talk about mental health, my mental health? Like, what was the kind of transition, do you think? What shifted that made that okay in culture?
I think that a lot of people were speaking up about their mental health around that time. I think year after year, unfortunately, the Black community is always experiencing some form of racial injustice in this country. And I wouldn't be surprised that around that time, something was happening in our society that really helped people recognize that we have to do something differently because we're suffering. Our mental well-being is suffering, and we can't keep going the way we have always been going. And I think a lot of people also realize that at that time, the idea of trying to be strong. I think self-care became a big buzzword around that time as well. And I think it definitely impacted Black women because of the strong Black woman trope and this idea that we have to be everything to everyone. We're not allowed to have a bad day. Black women, for example, experience high functioning depression and anxiety because at the end of the day, regardless of what you're feeling, sometimes you realize the world isn't going to stop because you're having a bad day. So you have responsibilities and you have to figure out how to keep pushing through and become resilient regardless of what's happening around you. But I think Black women also started to realize, despite knowing that as truth, we can still be proactive in caring for ourselves and setting boundaries and recognizing that we matter too. And we have to be the first person to put ourselves first. So I think for me, that is what I was being exposed to, the messages I was being exposed to. And I think also because I was just a year out of grad school, I too started to recognize that I needed to put my cape down and really learn to seek support.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. So what was the insight? And this is kind of the, you know, the kernel of this show is like, of this podcast is trying to understand in your own journey, in your own story, what was it that clicked for you that was a turning point that made you go, you know, I am doing this in my life. Actually, I can and I want to go out there in the world and be of service in terms of mental health. And, you know, there are no rules on this show. You can at any point in time, whatever feels right, whatever makes sense to you. But just one of those moments that clicked that helped you understand your own path and how you move forward to becoming who you are today.
So that clicked for me way beyond 2015. Me pursuing my degree in social work is where that pivot came from. And I think for me, I was probably in my early 20s when I started to realize that I had a lot of unhealed trauma that was getting in the way of me, one, being able to give myself the life I felt I deserved. It was also impacting just my well-being and my mental health, but it was most importantly impacting my ability to build community and have healthy relationships. You know, in my line of work, community care is where my expertise is. I am someone who really believes in the value of connection and belonging, and I believe that regardless of all this self-help work we do, at the end of the day, we exist to integrate into community, to be a part of relationships. Mm-hmm. We don't do all this healing work because we're trying to lock ourselves in our houses all day, right? Even though some people will try to do that, we still yearn for connection. We're wired for connection and we're meant to be in community with people. And I think what was happening for me was I was really angry. It's so funny when I think back at like my trauma responses. I am someone who, and I'll be transparent and share this, but my trauma response tends to be fight. Okay. Right. And so piss me off and I'm going to go from 0 to 1,000. Uh-huh. And in my early 20s, right, I'm being honest here, right? Like in my early 20s, I was at 1,000 pretty much every day. You look at me the wrong way, you speak to me the wrong way, it's a problem, right? And it's because I have a narcissistic family member, and I do not use that word lightly, right? Okay. A complete personality disorder. So if you've ever had to deal with someone who is narcissistic, it is exhausting. It is draining. They are pathologically selfish, pathological liars, all of these things that can be so hard to interact with. And my way of dealing with that, and I guess because I had to deal with that since I was a child, I was like, no, I'm not people pleasing for you. Like if we have to fight, we can fight. like you're not about to get over on me and try to push me or like feed me lies. Like I see through the manipulation and it started to get to a point where I did not realize this person had impacted me so deeply that I was just walking around angry at anybody. Mm-hmm. The anger started with them. And I guess because, again, this is a family member who I had to see every day, I had this guard up where it's like, if anybody I encounter has the audacity to disrespect me, we're going to have a problem. And I found myself throwing tantrums, being someone that I did not want to be, honestly. And so it wasn't until my early 20s where I started to realize I'm engaging in some behaviors that I'm not proud of. I'm very snappy. I'm being rude to people. I'm not being the person that I know I can be or that I want to be. And it's because I'm carrying a lot of anger. I've been dealing with traumatic experiences and traumatic relationships my whole life. I remember at that time too, my father had died when I was 19. So I was just filled with grief, rage, anger. And I realized, but this is not how I want to move forward. And I think for me, that was the pivotal moment, because not only did I have that self-reflective process, it was really the people around me that were calling me out, the people who loved me, the people who I knew cared for me, who were like, girl, like, your anger is a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a lot. And there were times where I would be so angry, I would black out in anger and not remember my behaviors. And wow. they would see it. And then I would be like, well, what happened? And they're like, you don't remember what happened? And that's when it started to hit me where I'm like, okay, this is really deeper than what I thought it was. And that's when I decided to pursue therapy while also pursuing grad school. So I had a beautiful moment where when I decided to get my degree in social work, that was actually my first year as well, seeing a therapist. So I got to be in school learning about human behavior, learning about trauma, while also unpacking my own trauma, my childhood trauma, and all the different things that were getting in the way of me being my best self. And I think that is what led me to where I am now.
That's incredible. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all that. I know that's going to be, you know, really, really helpful for a lot of people. And it's wild the amount of just symmetry that we've had in our own experiences. You know, just hearing you talk, I was like, wow, this is kind of like a mirror. This is close. Also, narcissistic family member. Also, father died when I was 20. Mm-hmm. Also, in my early 20s, I was doing the same thing. I mean, mine wasn't anger. I took it from more of a shutdown approach of, like, I didn't react. But what I did was, like, well, I suppose it was reaction, but it was always trying to find a way to intellectually, like, be a bullshit destroyer. So, like, if anyone tried to give any attitude, I would, like, dress them down to the core, like, very sharply, or say something really, really deep and cutting. And it also weaving in some humor to it too, as, like, a defense mechanism, of course, to, like, put the flavor, like, you know, a little sugar in the medicine, you know. So it's like, I can still do what I want to do, but also the optics of it look all right ish you know. And that was my defense, you know, in the same way that, you know, that yours was anger or protectivism. And yeah, I had, like, friends that were close to me that were like, dude, you don't have to deconstruct and, like, be like that with everybody. And I remember an experience that really clicked for me was a good friend of mine who's really, really cool and really authentic. And we were walking and we were downtown. This, you know, homeless person came and asked for money. And I gave him this, like, ridiculous, stupid, like, talk about, you know, whatever I was saying to him. And I thought I was clever. And also it's because I was uncomfortable and I was doing all this. And my friend was like, man, you don't have to try and show them that you're smarter than them. You don't have to try and, you know, do that to everybody. Just, like, you got to let that go. And I remember thinking, like, okay, if this friend is telling me that, then that's real. You know, that's real. And that's really whenever I started trying to figure it out, like you did. And then, you know, I went on to doing the exact same thing, you know, eventually, is like trying to help other people, you know, in the same way, to not kind of feel and be hung up in those same patterns that I was. It's really amazing.
Yeah. And I think shout out to the people who are brave enough to call us out, You know, because I think that what I'm hearing in both our stories too, is there was someone there who knew us well enough to be able to say, like, is this really how you want to maneuver through the world? Like,
yeah.
Being mindful, helping me recognize, like, look at how you're draining your energy. Look at how you are disrupting your peace. Like, look at how you are showing up in the world. And do you really feel like this is a way forward? Do you feel like this is who you really want to be? And that's why, like, in my work, I really focus on community building so much, because we need people like that. We need people who are going to say, like, listen, like, was it really necessary for you to say all of that?
Yeah.
You know, I don't have change, right?
Yeah.
Or, like, was it really necessary to raise your voice and start screaming? You know, and I'm grateful for those moments, because even in the midst of me healing, those voices were often in the back of my head, where I found myself wanting to react impulsively. And I'm like, wait a minute. Let me calm down, because my friend is right. Like, is this who I want to be, especially publicly? Like, is this who I want, how I want to show up in the world? And I realized no. And I also don't want to be just as bad as that person who I've spent my whole life being angry at, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think that played a huge role in just me being able to tap into that self-awareness and do the work of healing.
Yeah, beautiful. How do you think that people can be that friend for others and do it where they feel like comfortable with it, and also know when the time is right to do it?
Well, I think in friendships, it's really important to practice compassionate honesty. And I don't mean brutal honesty, where you're just saying whatever to be mean and put someone down. But I do think compassionate honesty is when we take the time to be very mindful of our language and really let someone know that we want to support them, but at the same time, we want to be honest friends with them and name behaviors, because I know what your goals are. And so since I know what you're working toward and I know your desires and I know you want this particular thing, how can I play a role in helping you realize the barriers and obstacles and the way you might be self-sabotaging to get to where you're trying to go? And I think compassionate honesty is extremely important for the friend who's giving it. But I also think compassionate honesty is important for the receiver. I think and I don't know if this is a result of social media, because the way I see people respond to certain comments, I'm like, is this just like a social media thing, or is this really how people are existing in the world? Where I feel like a lot of people really don't want to hear the truth. Mm-hmm. And I find that a lot of people struggle with direct communication. And I think this culture of boundaries has made it so hard for people to live in flow and in community and practice compassionate honesty. I think in my work as a therapist and just a mental health educator, I do find that people do like being lied to. And I think that's a hard truth a lot of people don't reconcile with. But when I have conversations with people and I hear the way they dissect the problem and the things they wish people would have said to them, what I hear is, you wish someone would have just lied to you to make you feel good. And I think the first step to all of this is, because I can be compassionate, I can refrain from being judgmental, and I can offer you empathy and all of these different things. But if you're not ready to hear the truth, you might just call me mean and evil and say mean is the worst person in the world. You know? And so I think it's both parties that have to come together and say, well, if I want authentic friendship, am I open to receiving in this friendship? And if I also want authentic friendship that's rooted in reciprocity, am I comfortable enough to pour out and say to my friend who I love and I care for, hey, like, maybe we should talk about what happened, or maybe I should address something, because, again, you've shared with me, you've opened up your business, you've shared your business with me. And so therefore, I'm just providing some advice, or I'm just providing some insight to name something that I'm witnessing. I'm not judging it, but I just want to name it so that you have clarity, because I also might realize you're complaining about the same thing over and over, but I'm realizing, like, but these are your actions. Have you reflected on that? You know? And so I think that that's just really important for people to be open in their friendships enough to receive someone wanting to be compassionate enough to talk to them about things that are happening in their lives. And I think we also have to be brave enough to share those things, and just acknowledge sometimes too when someone's not ready to hear what we have to say. But I think radical acceptance and openness is the foundation to that type of pure, authentic relationship and connection.
This podcast is sponsored by AG1, the daily foundational nutrition supplement that supports whole body health. I drink AG1 every single day because, you know, I don't like having to have a lot of different supplements. I like taking supplements. I have experimented with them for over a decade and really found what the good ones are and what the not so good ones are. And the best thing about AG1 is that it combines kind of a bunch of different things you could be taking into one simple formula. So every time I take it, and the reason I take it every day, I notice better energy, better mental clarity, and a better ability to sustain my work throughout the day. So it's really great. Also, knock on wood, I never get sick. And I imagine the AG1 has something to do with that too. It's super easy. You just take one scoop, mix it with a little bit of water. You drink it. It tastes good. It tastes healthy. It takes 20 seconds and you're good to go. This stuff is blowing up. I live in Austin, Texas, as you know. There's AG1 billboards. It's on the sides of buses. There's, you know, planes flying through the air with banners. It's everywhere, and that's because it's great. So if you want to take ownership of your health, try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs, which I love those. I use those anytime I go anywhere. With your first purchase, go to drinkag1.com/astral. That's drinkag1.com/astral. Check it out. Yeah, that's really such good advice and really beautifully articulated. And one of the things I'm hearing in there too is like, maybe there's an important kind of vibe check for the person who's trying to help their friend of being like, okay, I am... all of my intention in bringing this up is to just help them. It's not for me to kind of react or to take out the feeling that I'm feeling being around their behavior on them, or to try and say something that's gonna, you know, like make them feel shameful or anything like that. But it's really just there to be like, hey, I'm here because, and saying this because I just really want to help you not feel that way anymore.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's where the compassion comes in, you know, because I think I think the other part to discern is like, I'm sharing this because I recognize my friend's goals versus my goals. Because I think sometimes too, what we might do in our friendships is we might project and say, well, this is what I want for you. But your friend might say, well, I don't want that for myself. Right? So yeah. I appreciate your feedback and you sharing it. But when it's a consistent thing where you're bringing up the same thing over and over and over again, it's like, this is your discomfort to work through, because it's very clear that you're uncomfortable with my choices, but I'm comfortable with my choices. So that's a you issue that you have to work through. So I think it's really important to use discernment when we decide we want to address certain things in our friendships, because again, it's like, is this information for my friend to help them meet their goals? Or am I just sharing it because I'm projecting and I really want my friend to align themselves with the goals I want them to have in their own life? And I think that's really important, you know, because I see in friendships all the time where people will say like, this is what I want for you. I think this is best for you. But that person is clearly showing you like, listen, I don't want that for me. And you also have to be okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. That's such a good distinction to make. You mentioned the culture of boundaries earlier. I perceive that to be a slight criticism of how people have used boundaries. Do you feel that they are being misused in kind of all of the language and just all of the stuff in social media now that is about boundaries? Do you feel like those are kind of being understood incorrectly or misused, or did I misunderstand what you were saying?
No, you're right. I do think that boundaries are definitely being misused. I think that a lot of people, and I think it's being misused in two ways. I think the first one is the idea of erecting a boundary. I don't think a lot of people are realizing that they're erecting a what they think is erecting a boundary is them really trying to control someone. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of goes back to that, what I literally just said about friendship, right? And recognizing, is this their goal or is it my goal that I'm trying to project onto them? And I'm sure a lot of us saw the Jonah Hill text messages that went viral recently, where he's telling his ex-girlfriend, she's not allowed to serve. She's not allowed to do this. This is what you can do, what you can't do. And those are rules that you're trying to give someone to control them. That is not a boundary. Your boundary is always about you. Your boundary is, this is how I show up in the world. This is what I tolerate. This is what makes me feel comfortable. And this is how I respond to things that make me feel comfortable. So I think that a healthy boundary is when you're trying to date someone and they share with you, this is who I am, you decide and realize, well, you know what? I don't think our values align, because maybe you do a line of work or you do certain things that just don't sit well with me with what I'm looking for in a partner. So I need to draw a boundary by saying I'm not able to engage in this relationship, versus saying you have to start doing XYZ to make me feel good and to make you more desirable to me in this relationship, you know? And I think this is where boundaries are getting a bit misconstrued, because I think too, with therapeutic language and mental health being on the rise, people are really starting to control and manipulate, but they're using certain form, certain words to really soften the language that seems like I'm being caring, I'm being compassionate here, but really, no, you're being controlling, right? Mm-hmm. Being manipulative, because this is who I am. You don't get to tell me who to be in the world. And if you don't like that, you don't date me, right? That's literally what dating is. You move through the world and you meet with people and you open yourself up and you be curious to learn more about them. But when you realize they are someone who have certain beliefs and values that do not fit your own, you realize this is where we part ways. I realize we're not aligned to be with each other. Not now I need to force you to conform so that you can be the perfect person for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where boundaries are just starting to get very misconstrued, because I'm like, you know, a boundary again is always about you. And I don't know how we got to what feels a little chaotic around the culture of boundaries, because the more I see people talking about them, the more I'm like, this is not a boundary, you know? And I think it can be hard to digest content that you're just reading online without having the space to really have a conversation and engage in nuance. You can't engage in nuance on social media. Right. And so I think that is why I feel like social media has played a role in why so many people are confused about boundaries, and also remembering that no relationship is equal. So I might call out of work and tell my boss, listen, I'm taking a sick day. It's not your business. I'm not telling you why I'm taking a sick day. I'm not telling you why I'm taking PTO. But if I'm in a relationship, I feel like I have an obligation to explain my boundary to someone who I'm literally living in alignment with, mm-hmm. right? I might not want to share my business with one particular person, but maybe I do owe an explanation to someone else, which is why I'm also against the idea that no is a complete sentence. I think sometimes we need to know that somewhere along the way in certain relationships, right? And so that is my perspective on where we are in this culture of boundaries.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really clear perspective. I love the way that you describe that. I see that as well. And, you know, in that same neighborhood of the boundaries being misconstrued, there's sort of, I've noticed this interesting texture of like people misconstruing mental health words, and particularly stuff like letting go or leaving behind or like not for me in quotes, kind of that type of stuff. And it's turned into a type of avoidance. It's kind of like, and I feel like boundaries is kind of in that same area where it's like using that stuff to, instead of recognizing a, you know, real problem or something like in your life that you're integrating and you're recognizing, okay, I don't want to be like, let's say if you're drinking like 6 cocktails a night and you're like, you know what, I need to like, let this go, this behavior, I need to leave behind this part of what I've been associating with. So I know that I can feel, you know, better and healthier and get more to the place that I want to be, as opposed to someone like, I don't know, saying something that you don't agree with. And you're like, I'm never talking to them again, because you know what I mean? Like, 'cause it challenged my ego. I'm going to leave them behind. And it's like, because of the language is so prevalent and so sort of, as you nicely put it, softly used, there's not a lot of clarity in those things, so it allows people to kind of use them and leverage them to their advantage. Do you see any of that happening as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that being able to receive a boundary, being able to receive feedback, being able to just receive on the other end is also important. And I do think a lot of people take the information that they learn and say, well, in my personal life, I'm going to apply it like a blanket and treat it as if it's this universal coping mechanism, when the reality is, like I said, no relationship is equal. So there are going to be times where someone might give me feedback where I'm like, child, please. Right? Like, yeah. I don't even know you. Like, you don't know my personal life, but you're sharing something with no context, right? So your opinion literally doesn't matter to me. But if you're my best friend, if you're my partner, if you're my parent, if you're someone I truly care about who knows my life intricately on an intimate level, I will be more open to receiving what you have to say because you know me. I also have invited you into my business. I made a choice to disclose certain things about myself, right? And so I think that we are living in a culture where a lot of people are struggling. I think it goes back to that nuance piece with taking everything that they're learning online and recognizing that this is not a one-size-fits-all approach. And I think sometimes where we are in social media in the context of mental health, you know, I think that there's a lot happening that I'm curious to see how it will continue to play out over the next 5 years, but, or even more beyond that, right? Because it makes me think about what it truly means to be in a therapeutic relationship with someone. When a client comes to me, we're doing a biopsychosocial. I am interviewing you about your childhood, about your family upbringing, about your socioeconomic status, about so many things. And I'm going to learn more about what brought you to the therapeutic relationship, what's happening to you on a current level. Then we're going to work on, assess what are your goals? Is there a diagnosis? Let's develop a treatment plan. The therapeutic relationship is so deeply intimate. You are not getting that on Instagram.
Yeah.
You're not. So yeah. Even if the therapist is posting the concept of letting go, the concept of leaving things behind, literally, if I have 20 clients, the concept of letting go and leaving behind is going to look extremely different on a client by client basis.
Right.
So how do we expect someone to just take one quote, one post with 5 bullet points and just say, I'm going to apply this to everything in my life? And so I think that's where I wrestle. And sometimes I even self-reflect and I say, like, should I be continuing what I do? Like, how can I alter my language on social media? Because I'm becoming more open and aware to this culture where I do see a lot of people responding in a way that it's like, oh man, no nuance is being applied. This is being treated like a one-size-fits-all approach. And that's not the goal here. So yeah, I do think that there's so much to continue to do. So much will continue to evolve over time with social media content and just like its integration into mental health culture. But those are just like the running thoughts that often like go through my head.
Yeah, definitely. And like, as you said earlier, people generally want you to lie to them so they can look at these posts online and be like, okay, well, you know, check. I'll apply this stuff in the way that suits me and I'll go on believing that I'm actually growing or like advancing in some way, whenever really I've just taken these out of context ideas that may not even be well written or well researched. You know what I mean? It's like someone that's totally unqualified, you know, talking about something that they should be qualified to talk about, and someone will see it and be like, okay, cool. And what's crazy is that like whenever you talk about being reflective on what you put out in the world, like I feel that as well. Fortunately, I have no qualifications, so you know I don't have the same rigor as you have to deal with. But you know what's interesting that I found is I think about that because I like to try and get to things that are like clear, logical truths that people can then think about themselves. Like, this is an answer. Here is something to experience. But what's funny is that the more crisp I make those ideas, I feel like the less engagement they get. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So like whenever you're really putting something on somebody, they're sort of like, I don't necessarily want to, I didn't come here to chew on all that, you know? But when you give somebody something a lot lighter and a lot more open, then it goes viral. You know what I mean? And so it just kind of shows, like, of course, everyone's different that's experiencing and using social, but like at large as a culture, like looking at growth and personal development, social media, a lot of people are looking just to read things that make them feel good as opposed to reading things that make them actually do some difficult inner work.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think that some people are looking for their biases to be confirmed and validated, where it's like, I have this perception of someone, oh, I just read this post. You know, I've received so many messages before where someone will say, I sent this post to my mother. I sent this post to my partner. I even had someone DM me once and say, so my girlfriend sent me like a few of your posts and I'm so confused on like what's happening. And I'm just like, listen, I can't like in my DM, you know, but like, I do think that sometimes without being challenged the way you would in an actual therapeutic relationship where someone is actually giving you feedback, someone is actually helping you self-reflect, someone is actually providing you guidance, it can be hard because you're literally just staring at a screen, liking a post, and taking it and doing whatever you please with it. Right. Without someone being on the other end to say, well, the person who wrote the post being able to really engage with you and say, oh, wait, actually, based off the information you're telling me, this post may not apply to you. You're trying mm-hmm. to put yourself into something that's not actually about you. Yes, this post is about trauma, but maybe this post is more fitting for someone who experienced a different form of trauma. Or remember, symptoms of trauma is not universal. So there are people who are walking around with certain symptoms that you may not be experiencing, and this post was for them. And so I also think that that plays a role in like, just the confusion that social media can cause for certain people. And I really just hope that as people listen to this, they again will use more wisdom and discernment when they're absorbing content, especially because I'm quite sure the average person at this point, if you are into wellness, you're probably following multiple therapeutic accounts. You're probably mm-hmm. following multiple inspirational accounts. A lot of people aren't just following one particular person anymore. It's like, I follow 50. And now you have 50 people, you know, sharing so much content on what to do. And some of it can even be contradicting, right? Because you also don't have someone to sit with and dissect that content to see how it actually applies to your own well-being.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. And, you know, coming from the background for me of kind of like secular spirituality and mindfulness and consciousness philosophy and things like that, one of the things I noticed early on was a lot of people liking posts and listening to podcasts and being around the stuff that they sort of thought like, hey, if I just engage with this content and I sort of filter it through my life a little bit, then I'll be making the advancements that I want. And it becomes this kind of veneer of development where people just go, oh, if I go read, you know, to translate to what we were just talking about, if I go read 10 inspirational or mental health posts a day, then I'm getting better. It's like, no, you're just like putting on the costume of, you know, of someone who's doing, and not to say that someone can't see something and it will spur a type of insight that will then lead them to actually do something. That's certainly true. But it's just an interesting word of caution, I think, for people to like make sure they're not just, you know, putting up a bunch of ornaments and not actually, you know, really getting in there and using the stuff to make real progress.
Right. No, I agree. I definitely agree. And I think the doing is important, or at least the mental shifting is important. But depending on what you're experiencing, the doing is really the ultimate goal. And so if you're just listening and absorbing and absorbing, it's okay to be in a state of pre-contemplation, but your life isn't going to change until you take action, you know? And I think that's what's really important for people to really understand.
Absolutely. Actually, in my new, or the book I'm just finishing now, I was talking about the stages of change model. I think it's such an important thing. I love that you brought that up, because I feel like, as someone who's observing, you know, hundreds of thousands of people going through this process, like on it through you know, the internet, like responding to my stuff and watching how people, the messages I get and things like that, is that one of the biggest things that hold people back is that they mistake the contemplation stage for the action stage. You know, is that they're like, well, I've been thinking about, you know, let's say meditation. Like I've been thinking about it, and I'm thinking it'd be cool to do it for like months. And then I tried it for 5 minutes, and then 2 weeks later I tried it for 5 minutes again, and now I'm frustrated that I'm not getting any better at it because I've been thinking about it. It's like, yeah, but you only did 10 minutes in the last 2 months, you know? And it's because our thoughts feel so visceral and so real that we mistake just having that idea in our mind for actually taking action. So that's such a good thing that you underscored, because it's really important. I think a lot of people miss that yeah. piece.
Yeah, I do. And I think some people do think that action is like, I listened to the podcast, and that's important, right? Because you do need to expose yourself to new information so that you can take action. But just remembering, it doesn't stop there. It's like, are you listening to it and actually absorbing it, really challenging some of your beliefs? Like, what are you doing with the information? Because there are a lot of people who, you know, they can read 50 books a week. And when you ask them, well, what'd you learn from? And it's like, I don't remember. I don't know. I was just doing it, right? I was just doing it because I was told, well, that's what you do. And it's like, well, why do it if you're not gaining something from it? I'd rather read one book a month that I'm actually going to absorb and is going to impact my life versus reading 50 a week where you're just trying to check off a box because you're like, well, this is what the wellness culture says to do, right. You know? So, yeah.
No doubt. Yeah. Yeah. I read two or three books a week a lot of times, but, and I, you know, I absorb them, but then I'm guilty of, then I can't remember which book the thing came from. Cause I'm like, oh, I heard this great idea. And it's like, it was from, I don't even know which one it was from, but it's still a good idea.
And speaking
of books,
movies, anything.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, speaking of books, your new book, Owning Our Struggles, first off, the cover design is totally dope. Love that. But yeah, I'd love to just talk to you about it for a minute. You know, congratulations on it. That's amazing. And it's through Tartier Perigree, right?
Yes.
Awesome. Yeah. That was my first book was through them in 2019. Wow. They're nice people over there. So I'd love to, you know, just tell me about it. So it's dealing with challenging emotions, and each one you kind of go into and reflect on and help people guide with how to work with those.
Yes. So basically the way I structure the book is it takes the reader through a journey throughout life. And so chapter one takes the reader on a journey to first explore childhood, because that is our starting point. From there, it expands to different areas in our lives, ranging from our own self-reflection after we become adults and navigating adulthood. Then it takes us into various relationships. So our relationships with our parents, our relationships with our friends, our relationships with work, as well as our relationship to our cultural identity and what it means to be a person of color in this world. And the core premise of the book really is to help people heal through trauma through community care. I was really intentional when I wrote this book to make sure community was weaved throughout the whole thing and it centered community care, because my issue with self-help books is that it really focuses on the self. And that's a beautiful thing, right? We can't neglect the self-healing that we need. But what we also need to remember is that we heal to integrate into community. We don't heal to exist in a vacuum. We heal so that we can build healthy connections that really play a role in improving our mental health and well-being. Whether it's a connection with a partner, whether it's a connection with a friend, a connection with a colleague, we move through a world where we engage with people. And so if your self-help book is not teaching you how to engage with people, you can read any book, you can read a million books about boundaries. Until you apply that boundary and say to someone, I can't do this for you. I can't help you. The answer is no right now. Until you do that thing, you are not really going to understand what it looks like to integrate into a relationship because you're not applying those skills to relational building. Mm-hmm. And so I think even in our culture, a lot of the things that's hard for us to do is interacting with people when you think about it, which is why avoidance culture is so prominent, because it's like, well, if I don't have a boundary, or if I just avoid or give someone the silent treatment or sweep things under the rug, I'll feel better. And so what I really want people to do when they think about their relationships with their parents, their relationships at work, their relationships with their friends, their relationship with themselves, I also want people to be thinking about, how am I integrating community in this process? And that my book is really all about giving people the skills that they need to develop so that they can build healthy relationships.
That's amazing. Yeah. And I, out of all of the books that I've seen come through, you know, like, I haven't really heard of any focusing on community and relationships in that way. I think that's really a wise thing to bring into the conversation. What was it that made you aware that community was such an important part of ultimately just happiness?
So that actually goes back to my time in grad school. So my graduate program was a 2-year program. My first year I interned at a high school and I was doing one-on-one therapy with teenagers. And then my second year is really where my mindset shifted about therapy and really made me hone in on the concept of community care. I interned at a substance abuse treatment clinic called Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation, which is really well known here in New York City and many other towns as well. And at Hazelden, our treatment approach was group therapy. So you have people who enroll in this program, and I think the enrollment was for about like 6 months, the treatment plan. A part of their treatment plan was them doing one-on-one therapy per week, but 4 times a week, they had to engage in 90 minutes of group therapy. So I and my supervisor often led the group therapy sessions 4 days a week. And when I tell you, it was such a beautiful and eye-opening experience, that is what literally changed my life and perspective around therapy. I am not sure why in our culture group therapy is not raved about the way we push people to go to therapy. I really think people need to be exploring group therapy. And the reason why it was so beautiful is because in that therapeutic space, there was always about maybe 10 to 15 people per group. And like I said, always the same group because their treatment plan was about 6 months. And in that group, people had to do hard things. If someone in the group said something that offended you, you had to address it. If there was conflict in the room, you had to address it. If you were feeling shame, we talked about it. Literally everything that you learn in a one-on-one session with a therapist, you had to do it in this group setting. Versus when I'm with my therapist one-on-one, we talk about my mom, we talk about my partner, we talk about all these things. But when I leave the room, I have to find a way to apply it. And maybe fear comes up for me. Maybe avoidance comes up for me. All of these different things. And I don't have my therapist in my pocket where I go, you know. But in that 90-minute session, me and my supervisor, we're like, what'd you say to this person? How'd you feel about what they just said to you? Right? And even there are times where arguments broke out. And we sat back and we let it unfold. Mm. We let people deal with their trauma. And I think it was just such a beautiful experience watching that happen and realizing this was playing a role in their sobriety. people who turn to drugs and alcohol because they've dealt with traumatic relationships. Right. And here they are in a group setting, having to learn how to build relationship as a critical foundation to their sobriety. And people did it. Right. And so I think for me, it was that experience that opened my eyes to the power of community and recognizing what does it look like for us to communicate when hurt happens? What does it look like for us to communicate when an offense takes place? What does it look like for us to communicate and realize, actually, I think I'm communicating, but I'm not really conveying what I'm trying to say. And I have members around me speaking up for me or encouraging me in this room, because that is what the therapeutic relationship is like when you're in a group setting. So I never forgot that experience. And when I left NYU, I was very, very focused on community building. And so I worked in many different settings after that. I worked in community mental health. I worked in early Head Start, where I was working with children ages 0 to 5. And whenever you're working with children, you must work with their families. That's important. And so my community building was, how do I work with their families while also working with the school system, while also working with community resources to help them holistically and not just emotionally, because our emotions are often wounded by the systems around us and the people around us, right? And so I have always been community care focused because of that beautiful experience that I got to witness and play a role in.
Yeah, that's really wild. I never thought about that as a factor in and mental health and healing in terms of like, yeah, you can sit in isolation with a therapist forever and talk about stuff. And then when you get back out into the world, yeah, you're just not equipped and you're not in the trenches, you know, and you don't have to go through it. But yeah, being able to get into a dynamic where it's like something arises and you have guidance of like in a real world situation, how to deal with it. That's really amazing. They should put group therapy as like a high school class of like, put everyone, you got, you know, all right, you're 10th grade now, you're 16, whatever, time to do your, you know, your hour of group therapy every day. So, well, Mina, I know, you know, I want to be respectful of your time, but you're incredible. Thank you so much for coming on. You really are. I mean, your perspective, the way that you think and talk about things it's really refreshing and so intelligent and just clear. And I think, and it really is connecting, I think, with what's important right now. So just thank you for everything you're doing. You're awesome. And thank you for spending time with me.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me, Corey.